Ready to proceed?
May it please the court, Deputy Attorney General Williams, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. For the record, I'm Jan Van Emmerongen. I am appearing before this court for the second time in connection with this appeal. Michael Hayden is my co-counsel, and he regrettably was unable to attend this argument this afternoon, but he did wish me to convey his regrets to the court. As this court is well aware, and I will not belabor going through too many facts, this court remanded to the trial court certain questions for further factual findings upon a record. Judge Del Pesco, relying upon a record that had already been established during the pretrial motions in this case, did in fact publish her decision upon remand. In short, what Judge Del Pesco has done is, I believe, to credit Mr. Miller's testimony, the prosecutor in the case, over basically Mr. Bartley's testimony, emails that were in the case between Mr. Bartley and Mr. Miller, and the plain language of the statement itself, which was made by Mr. Cole. And the language I'm referring to is the language of Mr. Miller, both at the beginning of the statement and at the end of the statement.
What is our standard of review?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it is an abuse of discretion with respect to whether or not there is, an abuse of discretion is the standard. I believe that what the trial court has done in determining whether or not there existed a contract and her factual findings to support those decisions are reviewed by an abuse of discretion, or whether or not, and another way of putting it, I guess, whether or not she was clearly erroneous in coming to her conclusions.
Okay. Well, tell us, I assume your position is she was clearly wrong or clearly erroneous.
That's correct, Your Honor. With respect to whether or not there were certain terms as part of an agreement, it is apparent from the decision upon remand that the only agreement the trial judge found was basically contained two parts to it. All that Mr. Cole was expecting was that the state senior staff of the Attorney General's office would consider whether or not to take the death penalty off the table. And he was also hoping that Mr. Elwood Hunter, who was a co-defendant of his in the attempted murder Lancaster Avenue trials, would be exonerated and his charges would be dismissed. The language of Mr. Miller preceding the statement, indicating that what the deal is right now, and the language at the close of the statement, in which he referred to his statement at the beginning and then also talked about how the statement would not be shown or used in the sense that it would not be shown to Sticky or Larry Johnson or anyone else, is evidence that there were more terms to the agreement, that there was a greater understanding than simply what the trial judge has found. I think that that is further buttressed by Detective Chafin's testimony in this case. Detective Chafin was the investigating officer who actually took the statement, although it was in the presence of Mr. Miller and he contributed.
Let's assume that hypothetically it was an afterthought. After all the statement was given, that an additional condition of Mr. Miller was, well, we're not going to talk to Mr. Sticky or any of these other guys. Is there a consideration for that, or is that just simply a promise that's enforceable by suppression of evidence, or is that a contract?
Well, Your Honor, if I guess I have two separate parts to my answer. I don't think that it would have necessarily added to create a new contract unless it was specifically referring to a term that had already been discussed and it just wasn't mentioned in the front by Mr. Miller. However, when we're discussing contracts and good faith and fair dealing, I think that it is a reasonable expectation was created during the entire negotiation of the contract as such, and then also during the statement itself, particularly in light of Mr. Miller initially saying the deal right now is we're going to use this statement to take it back to senior staff, I think that all of that together does in fact bind the state to holding up that as part of an agreement.
Well, you're saying it, the evidence, there's only one conclusion, and that it was a contract, or?
Your Honor, I do think that the proper conclusion is that there was a contract and that that was included in it.
But is that the only conclusion that can be drawn?
The only reasonable conclusion, Your Honor. Certainly another conclusion could be drawn. Many conclusions can be drawn from many facts. However, in basically taking Mr. Miller's testimony at face value, I believe that the trial court has disregarded other evidence which would have shown that a reasonable conclusion is that, in fact, there was a contract. And the only reasonable conclusion is that there's a contract containing that term. The judge specifically referred to, the Rule 410 protections as if that had been something that was negotiated for. Mr. Miller's testimony was that that was discussed at length. I believe Mr. Bartley's testimony was, no, we didn't discuss that at length. It might have just been mentioned at one point. But I think it's important to remember the context of the statement being given is that it was in the middle of that other trial. The other trial was still pending. And what Mr. Bartley's recollection was that it was just mentioned that, of course, this isn't going to be referred to if we have to go back and continue the Lancaster Avenue trial. And I think with two experienced attorneys, I don't think either of them would have had to negotiate or spend much time on trying to negotiate for protections which are present in the rules of evidence regardless of anybody negotiating for them. I think that Mr. Miller's testimony was not credible with respect to that. I think that Mr. Miller, there were also emails that were referenced at that hearing between Mr. Bartley and Mr. Miller, and Mr. Bartley sent him emails, admittedly several weeks after these negotiations, and after the statement was taken, but saying, you do realize there, you know, of course, that we're not having any investigative purposes for this. And Mr. Bartley didn't testify consistent with Mr. Miller's testimony. Mr. Miller said that even though Mr. Bartley put in writing twice that this was our understanding, he supposedly admitted to Mr. Miller, in essence, that those were fabrications by saying, oh, yeah, you're right. I know that this isn't really going to come back and bite anybody or do anything, and there is no restriction. Well, Mr. Bartley certainly didn't testify to that. Mr. Bartley didn't say that in any of his emails. That was just Mr. Miller's testimony about that.
On whom should the burden fall when these kinds of agreements are reached between counsel to document or record the details of that agreement?
Well, as there are two parties, I'm sure both parties bear the burden of making sure that that happens.
Don't we have case law that suggests that if no oral agreement between counsel is enforceable because of the many mechanisms that exist for putting that agreement on the record, either in correspondence between counsel, by putting it on the record before the court, or otherwise documenting the agreement?
Yes, Your Honor, there certainly is. And I believe in this court's decision, in the sense that plea agreements and agreements between the state and defense attorneys and defendants, if there was no criminal rule specifically addressing that, certainly it's been addressed in this state and in this jurisdiction in the civil context often enough, and there is case law with respect to that.
Is there any significance to what I at least read as the trial court judge's finding that but does it all matter anyway, because Mr. Cole wasn't motivated to do anything he did as a result of this agreement? He did it because of a moral imperative, you know, which I find interesting that a criminal defendant is motivated by moral imperatives, but nonetheless, we'll put that aside for the moment.
Your Honor, it may be unusual that it happens, but I don't think that that is something that was ever disputed by anyone, that in fact what Mr. Bartley had testified to below was that, in fact, those words were used by Mr. Cole, and that the testimony was that Mr. Bartley told Mr. Miller that those words had been used by Mr. Cole. However, if that is the impetus for wanting to make a statement that clears Mr. Hunter, what Mr. Bartley made clear in his testimony was that he went to Mr. Miller and his reasons were twofold for doing it. One was to fulfill this moral imperative and free Mr. Hunter, who was not guilty of the attempted murders, and the other was to try and save his client, Mr. Cole, from facing the specter of the death penalty with respect to the 23rd Street incident.
Well, I didn't really articulate what I had on my mind very well. What should drive this? The motivation of counsel in entering into this agreement, or some separate motivation on the part of the defendant to act as in response to whatever the defendant thought the agreement might have been?
All right. Thank you.
Maybe that doesn't articulate it any better.
No, I think that it does, Your Honor, and I think that in the opinion, remanding the case to the trial court, although the decision set forth certain questions to be considered, earlier in the opinion, the court indicated that the issues seemed to be narrowing to whether or not it might have been a reasonable expectation of Mr. Cole, or maybe I've misphrased that, but words to that effect. I think certainly we do have to consider what Mr. Cole thought and what it was reasonable for Mr. Cole to think. And I believe that Judge Del Pesco, at the end of her decisions upon remand, addressed that I believe that what she was doing was addressing that. In finding that there was no agreement, in essence, she was saying Mr. Miller had no intention of doing any of that, and Mr. Miller didn't make those promises, and therefore there's no agreement. Reference had been made to the necessity of having a meeting of the minds and two parties, and if Mr. Miller didn't make any of those representations, there must not have been a contract. However, the trial judge then talks about Mr. Cole's present lack of candor and implies that this issue only came up because of, in essence, a reading of the language at the end of the statement from Mr. Miller, thus almost saying, using a Monday morning quarterback, Mr. Cole came up with this theory. And then the trial judge talks about how his recent Rule 61 belies that somehow. He filed something pro se, obviously without the assistance of counsel, indicating that his having been upset with, I think, the way that this statement was taken and how it resulted. I think that...
Was that part of the original hearing record?
No, Your Honor.
So that just sort of came in after the fact without... Any questioning about it?
It was submitted after, I believe, after all the briefing had been done before Judge Del Pesco. What happened after the remand, we did not expand the record. We just briefed, basically, to her on the record that already existed. And after that happened, Mr. Cole, as his 3 years, was approaching from the time the plea was entered, I believe with maybe 2 weeks to spare, handwrote a petition for Rule 61 in which he indicated displeasure with Mr. Bartley as well as Mr. Miller and in a general sense the way these things happened. And I believe it was sent to Judge Del Pesco by Mr. Miller, and I was copied on that.
Did you ask for any opportunity to either submit a memo on it or to ask questions about it or to address it?
We did not, Your Honor, and quite frankly, our thinking was that as that was, in essence, a very brief, pro se, handwritten note, I think Mr. Hyden and I were thinking that that wasn't going to play very much into this, and unfortunately that may have been wrong.
But do you have any present complaint about the process by which the judge reached her decision?
No, Your Honor, not about the process. Simply the decision that was reached. I think that a reasonable expectation, getting back to Chief Justice Steele's question, is very important. We have to consider what Donald Cole believed. That may be something that he takes up later on in Rule 61 if there was a discrepancy between what he and Mr. Bartley recall about that. But I think what is clear from this record is that Mr. Bartley and Mr. Cole believed actually that the death penalty was going to be taken off the table. One of the things that the judge did not discuss in her decision on remand is that Mr. Miller had sent an email the same day that this happened to Mr. Bartley saying that all that needed to be done, in essence, was corroboration, as if it was a done deal that there was going to be the death penalty taken off the table. And that is in his own right.
Corroboration was part of it, anticipated, correct?
Yes.
So how do you corroborate it without asking questions of other people, perhaps without not identifying the statement, but at least corroborating it using the statement? Don't you get to use the statement in some way in order to try and corroborate it?
You can corroborate that way, Your Honor, but I would think that a separate issue is whether you can then use the fruits of that at trial against Mr. Cole. What they did, the very first thing they did to corroborate was go out to the scene, and they went out to the backyard, and they found the screen window, which my client indicated was the point of entry. They found it in the backyard, and they found two slits in it consistent with the way he said entry had been made. Up until that point, the police did not know whether entry was made through a window or a door. There were no signs of forced entry that they were aware of. So they were able to do that without sharing the statement with anybody else. They certainly could have compared what they learned from that statement to statements they had gotten from other witnesses to see if that was consistent or not consistent. And at the time at which they confronted Trevanian Norton, I think it was improper for them to play part of that statement. It would have been improper for them to tell him that we have a statement in which Mr. Cole indicates that you were there. What they did was, in essence, pressure Mr. Norton using that statement, and based upon that, they built their own case against Mr. Cole.
But again, the foundation for this has to be contract, doesn't it?
Your Honor, yes. That is our position, is that it's contract, but that at the very least, a reasonable expectation in Mr. Cole's mind was that he was expecting a benefit of this bargain, and I would argue that he would not have made that statement but for his perception, and therefore it should be imputed not just this contract, but one of the things I referenced in oral argument before this court previously was that it then goes to even the voluntariness of his statement, and that can be raised as a potential issue, that because he did not truly know or intelligently understand that what he was getting into by making the statement, it was an involuntary statement as well.
Do you want to save your time?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice. Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, may it please the court. In this particular matter, the case has been remanded to the trial court to answer specific questions that were enumerated in this court's prior decision. The trial judge did not conduct a new evidentiary hearing. What she did was rely upon evidence that had been presented at two prior evidentiary hearings on February 20th and 27th of 2004, as well as Mr. Cole, Donald Cole's own affidavit of December 4, 2003. It's the state's position that the trial judge's findings of historical fact on this remand are supported by competent evidence and that the conclusions drawn therefrom are not clearly erroneous. On appeal, this court defers to a trial judge's findings of historical fact following an evidentiary hearing. As the finder of fact, the trial judge did have responsibility to resolve any questions of witness credibility. And here the issue arose because there was differing testimony from two of the attorneys, the prosecutor, Mr. Miller, and the defense attorney for the Lancaster Avenue homicides, Mr. Bartley. It was the trial judge's responsibility to resolve those conflicts and decide which witness was credible or not credible in those instances. As this court has said recently in 2004 in the Lopez case, where there are two permissible views of the evidence, the fact finder's choice between them cannot be clearly erroneous. So if there's two ways to view something, both of which are reasonable, a fact finder's choice between those is not clearly erroneous. It's simply the fact finder's choice in that case.
This, although there's been talk about this being a contract question, it's a contract question in the context of a criminal case and where there are disputes as to an understanding relating to evidence that's being developed for a criminal case. Shouldn't the state bear the burden of whatever ambiguities there might be that are the result of not having put this understanding in writing in any explicit terms?
Well, I guess that determination is going to have to turn on how far you want to carry the contract analysis. Normally, the party seeking to enforce the contract, the party seeking the benefit of the bargain, is the party that bears the burden. If you're going to shift the burden to the state on public policy grounds, I mean, that can certainly be done because there are these implied covenants, as the court has pointed out, of fair dealing. And but in this case, I think it is properly analyzed, as this court's already said, on a contract basis. And the trial judge agreed that this was a contract and that those principles are what apply. When parties in criminal cases have sought specific performance of plea bargain offers in the past, both the U.S. Supreme Court in Santabello versus New York and this court in Shields have said that a contract analysis applies here, and that you have to show detrimental reliance and normal contract type analysis applies here. So I think in the first instance, certainly the party seeking to enforce the contract should bear the burden. If there's been some overreaching or lack of fair dealing by the state, then I suppose the burden could shift, but you're going to have to show that in fact occurred here. I think the real problem in all this, and the trial judge analyzes it in some detail in a chronological fashion, is as she points out, that the language post-proffer, meaning after the statement of Mr. Cole has been concluded and the prosecutor is then making statements, that his language or his words are subject to misinterpretation. And that's where I think the whole issue here arises. But the trial judge, I think, correctly noted that there were two purposes for Mr. Cole making this statement initially. One was that, moral imperative or not, he was seeking to have the charges against his co-defendant in the Lancaster Avenue homicide dismissed, that is, Elwood Hunter's charges dismissed, because Mr. Cole knew that Mr. Hunter was, in fact, not one of the perpetrators in that attempted homicide, although Mr. Hunter had been identified, I believe, by one of the shooting victims in that case as the shooter. So it looked like, on the basis of the evidence, that there was a strong case against Mr. Hunter, and that he might very well be convicted if the matter was allowed to continue forward and go to the jury. So in that sense, Mr. Cole, in the first instance, I think, was really negotiating for what you would, in contract terms, refer to as a third-party beneficiary contract. The arrangement was that Mr. Cole was going to plead guilty to the Lancaster Avenue homicide, was going to make a statement and say what he knew about that, or attempted homicide, excuse me, and that in exchange for that, the party who would benefit was not Mr. Cole directly, but Mr. Hunter, who would have his charges dismissed. And that's, in fact, what occurred with Mr. Hunter. The second part that the trial judge pointed out on remand was an expectation on Mr. Cole's part, presumably at the prompting of his attorney, Mr. Bartley, that he should also, because of the ballistics evidence that was going to connect the two incidents, the Lancaster Avenue shootings and the double homicide 9 days later at 23rd Street, apparently some of the same weapons were used in both instances, the two home invasions, that because of that connection, and there was physical evidence that was going to be introduced, that Mr. Cole should also attempt to negotiate consideration from the state in not seeking the death penalty in that particular case. It was a home invasion. There was a burglary, a nighttime burglary, and two people were shot. So, excuse me, on at least two bases, multiple victims and a burglary, the death penalty was certainly in play as to the 23rd Street homicide. So that was what Mr. Cole was seeking in the case. When the trial judge originally addressed this prior to the remand, her assessment of all this was, well, all the state was promising to do as to the second part of the contract that might be directly beneficial to Mr. Cole, was to consider the matter, but it was not an upfront deal that the state was, in fact, not going to seek the death penalty, that they were going to take the statement from Mr. Cole. Mr. Miller said he had to have it reviewed by his senior attorneys at the Department of Justice, his superiors, and then a decision would have to be made. That Mr. Miller was straightforward in saying that he really didn't have the authority while he was in the midst of one trial to make deals about whether the state would or would not seek a death penalty in another prosecution that, you know, at that point had not really been solved. So the Superior Court went through all of this and correctly analyzed this in contract law principles. Furthermore, and I think this is important, the trial judge points out at page 9 of her remand decision that the terms of a contract are established before it is formed, not after. And that's important here because the most problematic statement by the prosecutor occurs after this. After the statement of Mr. Cole is completed.
Well, you can amend the contract.
Well, let me suggest to you that that's one premise that troubles me. And let me read to you from what you already know, but so you know what is in my mind. It is correct that after Cole finished giving his statement, the Deputy Attorney General made a statement. But it is not, and by a fair reading, one that was generated solely by what was on the party's minds for the first time at the end of the statement. He says, we'll terminate this, and I'm going to go back to my office and do what I told you I was going to do at the beginning of this interview. This conversation, I'm paraphrasing, this conversation is not over. We'll pick it up. Plus, you don't want us to discuss the substance of this outside this room. Now, there's nothing in his statement that says that, so that has to relate to that conversation and promise at the beginning of the interview. Yeah, we're not going to talk about this with Sticky or Larry Johnson or anybody else. If I understand what you're saying, but listen why this is still ongoing, there's a reason why we would want that. We know what you're saying to us, and we're going to hold up our end. But listen, we can't have anybody. The less people know, the less it's going to leak out. Whether you enjoy paraphrasing or trying to read literally what a court reporter takes down or what a lawyer says, I don't know. But that's the essence of that, at least arguably, is I'm not saying this for the first time at the end of the statement. This statement was in part premised not only because you wanted to help Hunter because you thought somebody that was not guilty was about to be found guilty, and it's not premised because you thought by being cooperative in that respect you might get some benefit when the higher-ups consider whether to seek the death penalty against you. But I've also agreed with you. In order to induce your statement, because it will be helpful to our investigation to resolve these two offenses, that we're not going to show it to anybody else. We're not going to show the statement that you've just given to us to anyone else. Now, whether that's just to reaffirm what was said before or whether it's just to instill confidence because they might have to come back to Cole later, based on what they further discover, to develop further statements from him, it sounds very much like a deputy attorney general, an officer of the court, saying, this is what we're going to do, this is what we're not going to do. And then contrary to the finding of the Superior Court judge, the state clearly did not limit its use of the statement to considering it whether to pursue the death penalty, to see that it complied with the rule of evidence 410, or to consider the statement only in a decision whether to drop charges against Mr. Hunter. They used it to further the investigation of both crimes, and they did so contrary to what the Deputy Attorney General represented to Mr. Cole. Now, how is then the Superior Court's ruling not clearly erroneous?
Well, I think what the court does, and the court candidly admits that the state was sloppy about this, and I think she actually uses the word sloppiness here, that the language is subject to misinterpretation, and probably
then we're back to what Justice Berger said, at least in part. If one who is an officer of the court who has the heavy burden of prosecuting people is sloppy in their work in a way that results in them taking steps flatly contrary to what they promised they weren't going to do, who bears the burden of that?
Well, even if the state does bear the burden in this instance, I think given a contract analysis here, you look at who are the parties to this. The parties were Mr. Cole and the state, not Mr. Bartley, who was simply the attorney for Mr. Cole. And what did Mr. Cole perceive? Well, as the trial judge points out, if you look at Mr. Cole's affidavit, he certainly thought that the state was going to use this statement or attempt to use this statement to corroborate what he was saying. In other words, they were going to check out the details. And as the trial judge also points out, well, what's the most reasonable way you're going to do that? Well, you can go back to the crime scene to try to collect more evidence, and they did that. They found the screen with the slits in it. Or you can confront the two perpetrators who are named Mr. Norton and Mr. Johnson.
That's where you lose me. That may be the logical thing to expect in the absence of a representation that we're not going to do the latter. There is no representation. We're not going to go back to the crime scene and check out with the physical evidence the details of what you've just told us. The representation is we're not going to show it to anyone else. We're not going to discuss it with anyone else. It's what I said at the beginning. We know it's your understanding of what we're going to do, and we're going to stick to our promise. That's in essence what that statement from Mr. Miller said. How in the world can you reach a reasonable conclusion that that's really not what he meant at all?
Well, I don't know if it's not what he meant at all, but what he meant was they were going to use this to confront the other perpetrators. And those are the people that he's excluding. Now, he says anyone else, and obviously the language is too general. He should have been specific and said anyone else but Mr. Norton and Larry Johnson. He didn't say that. So that's where the ambiguity is. And when you analyze things in a contract analysis, if there's ambiguity, you look to other things outside the contract, the surrounding circumstance of the parties, what the two parties to the contract in this case reasonably anticipated. And Mr. Cole is fairly straightforward. He certainly expected it was going to be corroborated. In fact, he says after Mr. Miller makes a statement, the post-proffer statement, he says, well, I think Sticky already knows. Mr. Norton apparently already knows
he's going to make that
statement.
That he believed that Sticky already knew. But Miller says, plus, you don't want us to discuss the substance of this outside this room. Now, other than the people inside that room, who isn't subject to learning about the statement and having it discussed with representatives of the state? It's the world outside the room that isn't going to know about this statement. Yet they went directly, as soon as they could after that, and violated that representation. Did exactly the opposite of what they represented to the guy.
Well, they certainly talked to Mr. Norton, and Mr. Norton then becomes the crucial state's witness here.
Was he in the room at the time?
No, he's not in the room.
How does he not fall into the group of people who are not outside this room?
Well, it's a question of whether you read the language literally, which the trial judge candidly admits is subject to misinterpretation or problematic.
Well, wait a minute. When you're reading the language of a contract literally, how can anyone say, we don't want to do that, because if you read it literally, it's subject to misinterpretation?
Well, that's where it comes into looking at the surrounding facts. And if you look at the surrounding facts...
Only when it's ambiguous do you look at the surrounding facts to cure the ambiguity. What's ambiguous about, plus you don't want us to discuss the substance of this outside the room? And in essence, the balance of it says, and we're going to comport with that understanding.
Well, I think what's ambiguous in that is that would prohibit the state from cooperating the state.
Only to the extent they discussed it with other people. Wouldn't prevent them from corroborating it in any other way, and you've just outlined another way.
Oh,
going
I know.
To the crime scene and checking out the details. The state limit itself to the scope or the ambit of its options to corroborate it by those statements?
No, I think the state's, well, state limited itself in some respect. They said, or Mr. Cole understood the statement, that it was going to require cooperation. The state simply wasn't going to accept what he said at face value and decide on that basis alone whether he was or wasn't going to be a capital defendant.
Yeah, and we agree with that. We agreed with that together 10 minutes ago.
All right.
It's the ambit of the corroboration that's in dispute, not that it could be or could not be corroborated at all. The state placed limitations on its ability to corroborate it by these statements that referred not only to what Mr. Cole had just said at the end of the statement, but also to what I was going to do at the beginning of this interview.
Yeah. But if you limit it that respect, there's virtually little importance in taking a statement. If you're not going to be able to confront the perpetrators that the individual giving the statement names, you're not going to corroborate it in any satisfactory fashion, certainly not satisfactorily enough to make an informed decision whether or not you're going to prosecute somebody in a capital case.
I'm sorry, Mr. Williams, I didn't mean to interrupt your sentence, but if one also reads this to suggest that in the course of the investigation it might be necessary to come back to Mr. Cole and confront him with what in the corroboration is inconsistent with what he said, you want him to continue to talk to you. So you've made the promise to him that there are no individuals with whom we will share this statement other than the ones inside this room, yet you go out and do the very thing you promised not to do. How is that not offensive enough that there ought to be some way to discipline the attorney that did it in the form of the outcome of this case?
Well, what they asked for at trial was to suppress any statements that Mr. Norton would make. Now, Mr. Norton is really the state's only witness at the trial of these two individuals for the 23rd Street homicide. He's the third person who goes in after the other two. I think he says he fires one shot in the air. He doesn't actually shoot at either one of the homicide victims, but he's there, and he's the one giving the eyewitness testimony. Certainly it's not clear, but when you have ambiguities, you have to look at the surrounding circumstance. Surrounding circumstances are that Mr. Cole certainly anticipated it was going to be corroborated in some fashion. And he already said that, as far as he knew, that Mr. Norton already knew about this. So, you know, we're really talking not about Mr. Norton, but Mr. Johnson. But it's Mr. Norton who's the witness at trial for the state.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just have a few factual points. Actually, Sticky was Elwood Hunter. Sticky is not Trevanian Norton. So when they say, yeah, we're not going to, or when Mr. Miller says, yeah, we're not going to talk about this with Sticky or Larry Johnson or anybody else, he's referring to Elwood Hunter, the man he's trying to exonerate. And I believe, I don't have the trial transcripts with me, but I believe it was clear that Mr. Bartley had already spoken with Mr. Capone, who was Elwood Hunter's attorney, with respect to the possibility that his client would exonerate Mr. Hunter. Mr. Williams indicated that he didn't see any purpose or very little purpose in getting a statement if it could then not be used. Statements are obtained all the time in criminal cases where they are certainly used as an investigative tool, but they're also used after a defendant, perhaps Mr. Cole, if the death penalty had been taken off the table and if a plea agreement of some kind had been worked with him, then they would have had him as a witness against perhaps Mr. Norton or Mr. Johnson and could have then used the statement to their benefit in that regard. Also, with respect to specifically indicating that they would not talk to Larry Johnson or anybody else, The record was clear. Detective Chafin indicated that he recalled the statement was played to Larry Johnson. He couldn't recall at the time of this pretrial hearing whether it was played to Trevanian Norton, but during the course of pretrial proceedings, Trevanian Norton's attorney gave a statement and actually then at trial testified at trial, and there's no question that it was played to Trevanian Norton and his attorney both at the time that they interviewed Mr. Norton. So the statement was played to both Mr. Johnson and Trevanian Norton.
What's your position on the detrimental reliance issue? The trial judge said that, as a matter of fact, there was no detrimental reliance. Is that clearly erroneous?
Yes, I believe
Why
it is.
Why is that clearly erroneous?
Well, I think that what the court is relying on for that is only that he recognized it was going to be corroborated. And finding that he knew it was going to be corroborated is certainly different than finding or relying only on that to leap to the conclusion that he's lying about not thinking it could be used for anything else when it flies in the face of what I think is a reasonable interpretation of Mr. Miller's own language as well as what Mr. Bartley testified to with respect
to. As I understood it, it's that whatever the prosecutor would or would not do, that your client was going to give the statement anyway because of the moral imperative.
Your Honor, I don't think that it actually is that clear with respect to that. It was clear that he wanted Mr. Hunter to be exonerated. Mr. Bartley suggested to him, look, you're going to get basically charged with the double homicide too, based upon the ballistics and the other evidence. Why don't you let me try and broker a deal for you that gets the death penalty off the table so that that doesn't happen to you? And he got the go-ahead from Mr. Cole to do that, and that's why he initially approached Mr. Miller with those twofold purposes. It wasn't just to get Mr. Hunter exonerated. Mr. Cole thought that, even though that was his reason for approaching Mr. Bartley to begin with, he thought that if the death penalty was off the table and I can get Mr. Hunter exonerated, I will give him a statement about both incidents.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise.